Welcome firstly to the city of Sydney, which after several weeks of rain has turned on a really glorious day for us today. And secondly, welcome to this, one of the conference's first bridging sessions on viral hepatitis co-infection. And the topic for this session today is really very timely and relevant given the recent advances in our understanding of viral pathogenesis, viral resistance, and the number of potential new therapeutic agents we have for the management of hepatitis B and hepatitis C now. Now, there is a change to the program as stated in the original conference book. Unfortunately, our first speaker has been unable to make it to Sydney, but we have three excellent speakers and talks lined up still. And as a plus, we may have a bit more time for questions and discussions as a result. So I'd like to hand over to my co-chair, Jürgen Rockstroh, who's going to introduce our first speaker.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. It's really my great pleasure to announce the first speaker, which is Marion Peters. Marion Peters is a professor of medicine at the University of California in San Francisco, is one of the world-leading experts not only in co-infection but also in mono-infection of hepatitis B and C, and she will give a very intriguing and interesting talk on small molecular inhibitors of hepatitis C virus infection, agents in the pipeline. Marion.
Thank you very much, Jürgen and Gail. And I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this beautiful country, which happens to be mine. I was told that I wasn't allowed to talk about any drugs that are currently licensed for hepatitis C, and was meant to give you an overview of drugs in the pipeline. Part of the problem, you can see, is there are a huge number of drugs in the pipeline, so I'm going to really choose those that are closest in terms of phase two, phase three studies. When we think about hepatitis C, you know it's a... could you press the button, please, Dr. Rostra? Or I'll talk all day. It's a single open reading frame which produces structural and non-structural proteins, the core and envelope proteins that are part of the virion, and these important proteins to the right that are really critical for the production of virus using host as well. However, they're not in a single line, but the topology of the proteins is such that there's a replication complex within a membranous web here, including NS3, NS4A, as well as the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase here. And when we talk about inhibitors, we may be just looking at one active site or inhibition of being able to produce an adequate replication complex. And I want to thank Charlie Rice for the use of some of his slides. So hepatitis C is replicated in the cytoplasm. It's membrane-associated, as I've shown you. Large number of viral particles produced per day. However, they're very error-prone, so individuals have a large number of quasi-species. And because of this, there's immense variability. This is increased with development of resistance mutations, and combination therapy will be absolutely required for management of hepatitis C, especially looking at small molecules, as well as perhaps multivalent vaccines. So when we think about hepatitis C infection and replication, we have to think first of entry and uncoating of the virus with receptor-mediated binding. Then we think about translational and post-translational processing, which is ribosomal, producing a polyprotein, then the production of structural proteins, assembly, membrane fusion, and secretion. So there are a large number of opportunities to interfere with hepatitis C replication. Virus-neutralizing antibodies have been unsuccessful as yet, probably related to constant mutations. Receptor inhibition is an area of active interest. However, while CD81, a scavenger receptor, and clathrin, as well as some other host proteins have been shown to be important in receptor binding and internalization. No one of these, inhibition of any one of these doesn't decreases replication, but doesn't stop it. So I think the story about receptor inhibition is not yet completely answered, and there's more research to be done. Envelope glycan inhibition, N-glycans are very critical in envelope glycoprotein E1 and E2, and they're essential for not only protein folding, secretion, assembly, as well as antigenicity, receptor binding, and cell entry. So they'll be important not only for entry into the cell, but also for binding and excretion from the cell. And they're in early stages of development as yet. And I think the recurring theme in my talk is many opportunities for inhibition of hepatitis C have been failed small molecules or failed antibodies. And what will happen over the next 12 months is really unclear. A couple of the drugs only failed last week or last month. So if your drug has failed and I don't announce it today, I apologize. Really, I think the most mature are replication inhibitors. First, we think of translation. Antisense oligonucleotides at the 5' untranslated region are going into phase 2 studies. Ribozymes have already been studied and failed, but I'm told they're making a comeback. Iris inhibitors are also undergoing early stage development and moving towards phase 2. And siRNA interference is really a very active both preclinical and phase 1 studies. And I won't go into any more detail of those, but rather focus on protease inhibition, which is probably the most mature area at present. The NS3 is a serine protease as its N-terminal, and as its C-terminal is a helicase. And it's responsible for cleavage of all the non-structural proteins in trans. And associated with it is NS4A, which is actually bound to the NS3, if you remember from my topologic diagram. And this binding of NS4A to the NS3 allows for the serine protease activity, providing stability and ER localization. And you can see in this ribbon diagram the substrate binding pocket and the NS4A outlined in blue. I got lots of pictures if you don't see that one. Here's another one. So the NS3 protein has not just the active binding site, here the serine protease substrate binding site, but multiple other sites as potential targets for antivirals. The first small molecule was BILN2061, which was most successful in genotype 1 inhibition, but there was cardiotoxicity in animals and it was withdrawn. The VX950 molecule is another serine protease inhibitor. It's a peptidome mimetic inhibitor of NS3. It's orally bioavailable. At present, it requires 8-hourly, not TID, dosing. It provides a decrease of 2 logs in HCV RNA, has significant side effects, and you will hear that also throughout my talk. Drugs that didn't fall off the cliff from side effects, they all have significant side effects. But then again, so does interferon and ribavirin, so they're in excellent company. The side effects of the VX950 are rash being the most common and quite significant, requiring dose reduction in some individuals, GI upsets, nausea, diarrhea, and anemia. Resistance variants are selected rapidly. However, after cessation of drug, you see a return to wild type within about 3 to 7 months, and I'll show you some data on that. The early studies of this drug known as telaprevir demonstrated this reduction of HCV RNA, and subset developed either a plateau or a breakthrough, and that was associated with development of resistance. And you can see on the bottom increasing IC50s required with development of single or double mutations. So Sarrazin and Stefan Zeuzem looked at these individuals who received monotherapy with telaprevir and compared individuals who were not on drug, on placebo, with those in green who had a continuous decline of 3 to 4 logs over 14 days and then slow return to baseline over another 14 days, and compared those with the resistance of those who had suppressed HCV RNA with those who had a plateau, which you can see in blue, or those who had an initial decline in red, but then a breakthrough. And if you look at the top, which is the red, the initial decline and then a breakthrough, you can see initially in a sort of ugly blue, or maybe it's a green, ugly green, it's all wild type. However, when the breakthrough occurred, a low-level resistance was seen, and this persisted up to a couple of weeks after cessation of therapy. And when followed out for 3 to 7 months, there was still some resistance seen, but the majority of virus, they only picked mutations when it was more than 5% of the 80 clones that they selected at every spot. When individuals plateaued, in other words, they didn't get the best HCV RNA drop, they had actually higher level of resistance with development of more aggressive resistance mutations. These also persisted up for another 2 weeks, and then clearly the majority return to wild type was seen. With the bottom panel where there was a continuous decline, below the limit of detection, obviously no resistance was seen, and after cessation of therapy, there was a small amount of resistance, which almost all disappeared at 3 to 7 months. These are the resistance patterns. You can see genotype 1A and 1B have slightly different IC50s, which has been repeated in a number of different assays, but apparently is within the limit of detection of the assay. Single amino acid changes in V36 or R155 or T54 led to increased resistance to the drug, but it's the 156 that gave the most resistance or double mutations. And if you look on the next slide, you can see that the 155 and 156 are at the active site and are thought probably to decrease binding of the drug to the active site when you get a mutation. Whereas the T54 and the V36 are not at the active site and are thought to be conformational change rather than a interaction of drug with amino acid, and therefore they actually have the strongest resistance is seen with mutations at the active site. And in gold, you can see the NS4A cofactor wrapped around the NS3. This is just showing you low level of resistance with single mutations and higher level of resistance with either double mutation or the A156V, shown in two different assays. When they looked at relative fitness of these variants, you can see on the bottom right is wild type, which has no resistance and excellent fitness. And as you develop a single mutation, you increase resistance but decrease fitness. However, production of dual mutations appear to increase the fitness back towards wild type. And they use this by looking at the IC50 as well as HCV RNA viral load. So this is an interim analysis of combination therapy. Obviously, monotherapy was associated with rapid high level of resistance. So John McHutchison at EASL in May presented this data of four different groups who either received interferon and ribavirin as the standard of care, or in triple therapy, interferon, ribavirin, and telaprevir for 12 weeks, followed by 36 weeks of combination interferon ribavirin, or triple therapy followed by 12 weeks, or in a small group, just triple therapy. Most of the individuals, these are not co-infected, and most of these studies I'll talk to you about today are not, had high viral load, and 10 to 12% were African American, traditionally very difficult patients to treat because of decreased sensitivity to interferon and ribavirin. What they showed is rapid virologic response is loss of HCV RNA at 4 weeks. And whether it's less than 10 international units or less than 30, you can see triple therapy markedly improved your rapid virologic response compared to interferon and ribavirin alone. And we think of 12 weeks as the decision point whether to stop therapy or continue. And those who had a negative EVR, so no HCV RNA detectable at 12 weeks, much higher on triple therapy than dual therapy. However, breakthrough was still the purview of the small molecule and much higher than in the pegylated interferon and ribavirin arm. It occurred in all but one patient in the first 4 weeks. Side effects were also higher in the triple therapy than interferon and ribavirin. When they looked at group D alone, that is the group who only received 12 weeks of triple therapy, these were 20 patients, three of whom didn't receive any drug, one withdrew consent at 1 week, 16 of them had undetectable HCV RNA during therapy, three were stopped because of adverse events, and all three relapsed. 13 completed 12 weeks of therapy. 9 of them met a rapid virologic response, that is negative HCV RNA at 4 weeks, and they stopped therapy at 12 weeks, and 6 of them had undetectable HCV RNA 20 weeks post-therapy. And of most interest, 2 of the 6 were actually African American. 3 of them relapsed. This is a very small group. Whether they'll have a sustained virologic response, the time of EASL didn't give them another month to give us those data, but it's exciting that so many patients actually appeared to clear virus with just, or suppress virus with just 12 weeks of therapy. Whether you'll get clearance is yet to be found. But an exciting finding with triple therapy showing the value of the small molecule, but still the reliance on interferon and ribavirin to decrease resistance. And Sarazen also looked at other protease inhibitors and showed both in vivo and in vitro resistance seen to the NS3. So I go back to my little topological picture to remind you that NS3 is intimately associated with NS4A, and that leads us to another prototype molecule, an Achillion molecule, an acethiourea, which is an NS4A antagonist that inhibits binding of the NS4A to NS3 proteinase and therefore inhibits activity, prevents the formation of this replication complex. The phase 1 was halted a couple of months ago for renal toxicity, but they have other drugs in the pipeline. And of great interest, they presented at EASL that no cross-resistant with protease or polymerase inhibitors. So what about polymerase inhibition? NS4B is an RNA-dependent RNA polymerase that has the classic palm finger thumb with allosteric sites of inhibition as well as the active site. And there are also both nucleotide at the active site or non-nucleotide opportunities for antivirals. Valopycytabine, which went off last week, but I'm still going to show the slide, was one of its the prototype drugs, and it showed a modest decrease in HCV RNA on its own, but more profound in association with interferon and ribavirin, a recurring theme I'm sure you're hearing. Both Idenix and Roche have nucleoside analogs. The one I showed you was valopycytabine on the left. On the right, the Roche drug gives a decrease of about 1.2 logs, but with interferon and ribavirin, it increases to 3.7. Again, side effects, GI upset or anemia. There's another drug which is a non-nucleotide polymerase inhibitors, resistance associated. However, on its own, a modest decrease in HCV RNA, but in combination with interferon and ribavirin, not only a more profound decrease in HCV RNA, but also no resistance over 2 weeks. Another drug which I put in here because it's associated, the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase actually binds cyclophilin, and cyclosporin has been shown in transplant patients to decrease HCV RNA. Debio 025 is a cyclophilin inhibitor. It decreased here, you can see on the left, HCV RNA over a 2 week course of therapy that actually showed quite a slow return towards baseline and was shown with more than just genotype 1. Once again, there were side effects here of elevated bilirubin and decreased platelets, but it brings a point of a host inhibitor, small molecule inhibiting the host protein that will decrease HCV RNA. And other host targets, viral assembly inhibitors, such as zelgosivir, which is an alpha-glucosidase inhibitor and is now being studied in being able to prevent virus assembly and secretion. Bavituximab, I know nothing about, but it's an antiphosphatidylserine monoclonal antibody, and it apparently will be studied in co-infected individuals. There have been some studies looking at CpGs to stimulate the innate immune system. Drugs studied so far have lapsed and fallen into disrepute, but they may come back. IL-7 studies looking at IL-7 antibodies might become drugs of importance. They're really in early stages at the present time. So I think we think of the issues for new hepatitis C therapies. We have development of single small molecules inhibitors, but you can see that they're really expanding across the spectrum of viral replication. So combination therapy is a possibility. There are multiple different classes of agents with complementary properties and no cross-resistance shown as yet. So the combination of more effective therapy will be really this combination of drugs that utilize different strategies for viral inhibition. As I've shown you, many of the prototypes are withdrawn for either poor efficacy or side effects. And I think this is a recurring theme in hepatitis C, and I don't have to remind this audience, they saw this with HIV as well. Of disappointment to many of you in the audience is the fact that there's synergy with the majority of these small molecules, and they increase interferon sensitivity. So that interferon and ribavirin will probably stay the mainstay of treatment for a few years yet. The studies I didn't show you showed that optimal response required the maintenance of a good trough concentration. That's been shown very nicely with two of the protease inhibitors. I also mentioned that some of the drugs are given 8 hourly. That's a big problem. It's not TID. So whether one can optimize formulation to allow for an easier drug use. I don't know about you, but I can't take a drug every 8 hours. I have enough trouble taking it every day. What about resistance? Big problem. Common, distinct for class, clearly decreased in combination with interferon and ribavirin. So hepatitis C resistant testing will be required in the clinical setting for these molecules. And the old 80-80-80, which we use with interferon and ribavirin, will not be sufficient adherence, probably be greater than 95% required. I wanted to thank Charlie Reich, Jean-Michel Pavlovsky, and Chip Schooley for the use of some of their slides, and to remind you that I've really shown you a glimpse of where small molecules have clearly played a part moving into phase 3 studies, but there are many, many different sites in both preclinical and phase 1 studies, and this talk will probably be 60% wrong next year. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Marion, for a great overview. I think we'll have to invite you back if things change that quickly. Do we have questions from the floor? Please go to the microphones, identify yourself, and ask a question. And until the first person walks up to the microphone, let me ask you one thing. With regard to the trough levels and the fact that some of these newer drugs, as the protease inhibitors, are being metabolized by the cytochrome system, you can envision that there might be drug interactions with HIV compounds. So do you think that, when would you envision that if it would be, you know, a drug would be developed for monoinfection, would there be extra hurdles in co-infection you would envision?
I think that's an excellent point. Clearly, PK studies will be essential for the major HIV players in association with hepatitis C drugs. And we actually at the ACTG with Rob Murphy have written a shell protocol to allow us to drop in drug X and study all the major classes to look for drug-drug interactions. This will also be a major problem post-transplant.
Microphone in the middle.
Nick Bellows from Dallas, Texas. Just a question about boosting the Vertex compound. Has that even entered? Because with most of our, since most of your, all, as you mentioned, all of your studies were in mono-infected patients, most of our patients that are on protease inhibitors now that are co-infected are boosted with ritonavir. Any data, any PK data on boosting of the Vertex drug with ritonavir?
I think they're looking at it. I have no data. I only presented what is published, and that's one article, and what is in abstract form, which was the majority of the data, and I have no access to any PK data. But obviously, boosting, one would hope, would help that problem. But if it had, they'd have everybody on it right now, and they don't.
Hi, John McGowan from New York. Since there's no DNA, no proviral DNA, what are the implications as far as resistance is concerned with recycling these drugs or putting them together with future options as they come down the line?
Do you mean in terms of archiving resistance?
Right, yeah.
Well, the only paper is Sarazen's paper, and they really very carefully looked, and they were conservative in only calling a mutant if it was greater than 5%. They only looked at 80 clones. One would assume that these resistance clones were archived. However, when they used combination therapy with interferon and ribavirin, they didn't get any resistance. So I have no data to answer that. And I am not a resistance expert. I inherited the resistance data to give to you when Avedan decided not to come to this meeting. So don't torture me too hard.
Any thought where they would be archived and where would that be persistent?
Well, that's another very interesting question, because when people have actually looked at differences between HCV RNA in serum, in liver, in peripheral blood mononuclear cells, in vaginal secretions, they show different quasi-species. So one might suspect that they may be protected environments within the host where some resistance seen, but you don't see it in the serum. But that's all postulate. I know some data from Andrea Kovacs where she shows clearly different quasi-species between different sites of hepatitis C replication.
All right. Thank you, Marion. So I'll hand over to Gail for the next speaker.
Okay, so I'd like to introduce our next speaker, Professor Stephen Locanini. Professor Locanini is the head of research and molecular development at the Victorian Infectious Diseases Reference Laboratory in Melbourne, Australia. He is also the director of the World Health Organization Collaborating Center for Virus Reference and Research. Stephen is one of the world's leading hepatitis B virologists and really has a unique insight into the complexities of hepatitis B resistance. And I'd like to invite him to give his talk today entitled Hepatitis B Molecular Resistance Pathways.
Thank you, Gail, for those kind words. It's not too far for me to come up from Melbourne, so I'm always happy to sort of hop on Qantas flight, and it never runs on time, but I get here and have a talk about hepatitis B. And I also wish to thank the organisers for their initiative in a co-infection workshop session. I think this is a really important issue, and I'm glad to see and have infectious diseases people come into the area. I think it's very important. All right, so the organisers have asked me to talk about resistance pathways, which has been a major area of my lab's activities in the last couple of years. And I thought I'd just set the scene for where we are. It was so gratifying to hear Marion, who's a hepatologist, to actually talk about combination chemotherapy, because in hepatitis B, we've really, unfortunately, have not had a lot of drugs roughly at the same time of approval to be able to do combination therapy studies. I'd have to say, actually, the field is reluctant to do combination therapy studies until we've burnt off all the drugs that we have. So I do hope that in the next 20 minutes, I can sort of show you where we will be in the next 3 to 5 years if we don't start doing combination therapy studies for what little drugs we've got left with efficacy studies in hepatitis B. But that's just a personal bias. So with that as a background, I think that in hepatitis C, I hope you don't make the same mistakes, because I do promise you one thing, Marion, I will not get into hepatitis C resistance testing because we're too busy with hepatitis B. Okay, there we go. So where we are in 2007, I think that we have these sorts of figures for incidence prevalence data. I updated them just last week with some data from a BMS kindly provided to me for the 4-year data on entecavir. And with lamivudine, we roughly run at 25% per annum. Adefovir, at least in naive patients, initially in the first year, naught, but then it does actually start to accelerate with 3, 11, 18, and 29%. These studies are pharmaceutical registration studies. They have limited value, but these are all we have to actually gauge resistance. I can reassure you in the real world of a service provider, which is what I am, on a day-by-day basis, that the resistance is much higher. And what is more importantly is that in this country, in Australia, we have adefovir approved only for lamivudine-resistant cases. So you can see that it doesn't work as well, where at least in the first year there are 3 studies where it ranges from 0 to 18%. The Korean study of 18% is quite shocking because the fact that normally in patients who are naive, you have 0%. So you can see where the problem is. And entecavir starts out at 0.1%, 0.4, 1.1 and 1%. So the rate is very low, again, in naive patients. Whereas in lamivudine-resistant patients, as you will see as we go forward, that the resistance does accelerate as well, with 6% in 1 year, 15, 35, and 43% by 4 years. Now, we have limited studies on FTC, and the case definitions for resistance, as I said, these are pharmaceutical studies, so they have their own particular case definition. And if you look at the tolbivudine Idenix data for the E antigen-positive patients, it was 4.4 and 21%. That was against the lamivudine treatment arm of 10%, which we know in the real world, in our case definition, is more like 25%. So you can at least double these values for tolbivudine. And interestingly, E antigen-positive patients fared much worse than the E antigen-negative patients. So really, I think that's a pretty, I would say, depressing story. So why is hepatitis B resistance a bigger issue in HIV, in hepatitis B than in HIV? Well, I don't have the time today to sort of go into the life cycle of the virus, but we really unfortunately have only one enzymatic target. That's the viral polymerase, which is a complex enzyme. And with that one viral target, we've unfortunately got one class of drugs, of nucleoside-nucleotide analogues. But the virologist and the medicinal chemist have classified those that one class of drug into three groups. And for the purposes of understanding the resistance pathways, we've found this quite a useful classification. So I'll bore you with a little bit of medicinal chemistry. That lamivudine and torbivudine are L-nucleosides. I mean, they've just had their sugar and their base basically rotated 100 degrees against the natural D-isomer. Adefovir, tenofovir, acyclic phosphonates, and entecavir is classified in our system as a cyclopentene compacted sugar against the guanosine base. Now, the case definitions that we're pushing the hepatologists hard to accept, which they seem to be in the more recent guidelines from the American Gastroenterology Society, is using a viral load definition, is that drug resistance and increasing viral load from nadir of greater than one log, international units per mil, not copies, international units, WHO reference standard, is the preferred case definition. But at the end of my talk, I'll show you data where we're now starting to have a bit of concern about that case definition, based on some evolution of new mutants that we're seeing in the patients. Increasing serum ALT, clinical deterioration of very late signs, and what is more recently being used in patient management is the use of genotypic markers of drug resistance within the viral polymerase. And if you just sequence a hepatitis B virus isolate from a patient baseline, you do get a lot of variation in the genome. Hepatitis B virus is a highly evolved pathogen of man. It's been around a very long time in our own Homo evolution, so that we it's a very adapted virus to us. There are 8 major genotypes and an enormous amount of genetic diversity within the genotypes. So really genotypic reference sampling comparisons with baseline samples can be a little bit fraught with danger. And really, it's often the second or the third sequence sample that really does help us in guiding our definition of primary resistance mutations versus secondary compensatory mutations. And we classify primary resistance mutations, and we have a very strict classification about this, that we're in the laboratory, we've established a significant antiviral effect loss as a consequence of that particular mutation, i.e. a significant shift in the IC50. And this is a classic infectious diseases definition. The secondary and compensatory mutations do not affect the IC50, but actually have an effect in replication yield or replication fitness. And unfortunately, in hepatitis B, we don't grow the virus very easily in cell culture. We do not have useful replication yield, replication fitness assays. So we have to sort of just best guess them on yield. But it's very important to accept primary resistance mutations are what we think it's all about. And I've summarised on this slide where, fitting that case definition, my laboratory believes that primary resistance mutations live. And here we have a linear representation of the viral polymerase and with the functional domains of the enzyme. And I've shown for you here the documented primary resistance mutations for lamivudine and torbivudine, basically 181T or V or M204V or I. Interestingly, for torbivudine, we only see the I, which for reasons I'm not 100% can explain yet. For adefovir and tenofovir, we see the A181TV and the N236T as primary resistant mutations. For tenofovir, we've seen isolates in co-infection with 194 plus 180 and 204VI in collaboration with Professor Soriano, and with 181TV and in association with 204 as a primary resistance mutation. For entecavir, it's not meant to say that entecavir engenders more resistance because of all the mutations we see. But what we, as you'll see in a minute, with entecavir, that we need at least 3 mutations to appear concurrently in naive patients to encode absolute resistance. Typically, these are at either a 180 and 204 with one of a 184, a 202, or a 250. That's the Bristol-Myers definition. We also see cases with 169. Now, these number of mutations that I've shown on the previous slide, what we've been able to characterise from our database and subsequent analysis is that we've identified and distilled these primary resistance mutations down to 8 important codons, shown for you here, and then we've looked at the natural history and the clinical information and the virological information generated from our database of over 3,000 patients now, and tried to sort of understand them in the HIV concept of pathways. And what I've shown for you here is the proposed key pathways that I would like to share with you today. And remember, the setting in hepatitis B land is that we started mainly with monotherapy. So patients tended to start with L-nucleosides, lamivudine or tolbivudine. They typically run down the M204 pathway. If they start with acyclic phosphonase like a defavir, they run down what we call the 236T pathway. Now, that's the majority of patients, typically between, say, sort of 60 to 90%. We've identified recently a third pathway, which is what we call the shared pathway, which is cross-resistant to both the L-nucleosides and to the acyclic phosphonates. This is the RTA181TV. As I said, in the setting of naive patients with entecavir, you need at least three mutations with a 180204 plus, a 184, a 202, or a 250 to appear at the same time. For entecavir naive patients, this is now just called this the entecavir naive pathway. Interestingly, for entecavir and lamivudine experienced patients, there only needs one mutation past this, the 204VI. We've been identifying more in the last 12 to 18 months multi-drug resistant pathways. So I'm just showing you one for today, which is actually resistant to every drug that we have in the laboratory, and we've isolated from several patients in Melbourne. It's the 181T, 233V, 236T, and an M250L. And the reason why I raise this issue is because I don't think Melbourne is unique to hepatitis B and drug resistance. I think that we just have a laboratory that's interested in drug resistance, and that's why we're seeing these particular mutations. 181T and 236T are critical in resistance to adefovir and to the L-nucleosides. Our feeling is that the 233 and the 250 are compensatory mutations, but you need this cluster to engender multi-drug resistance for reasons that we don't fully understand. But I think that there's a really important message here. So from our database of 3,000 patients, what do we typically see? Well, lamivudine monotherapy was our major sort of indicator in the first instance. We typically saw in the first instance the 180204 VI pathway, as you saw from my previous summary slide, which is cross-resistant to tolbivudine and clivudine. That occurs in about 90 to 95% of cases. Up to 5% of cases, we have the A181TV pathway, which is cross-resistant to adefovir and partly explains the adefovir non-response after lamivudine failure. What we interestingly have recognised and are about to publish on is that if you maintain lamivudine in the presence of the 180204, the virus continues to pick up adaptive compensatory mutations, typically a T184S or a 202I or an M250V. And why these are important are these are the mutations that we also need for entecavir resistance. These patients haven't even seen entecavir yet, but they're already resistant to it. We're now seeing clusters of mutations of 214, 215, which affect adefovir, and broad groups of clusters, especially in the Asian genotypes. The Asian genotypes are really quite different from the European genotypes, genotypes A and D for Europe, but for B and C. The L80 is a fascinating compensatory mutation, but does affect sensitivity to adefovir. The A181T is very frequent in the genotype Cs, and as I said, we've seen the 194 in association with Professor Soriano. Now, why is this important? Well, unlike Hep C, we definitely know that Hep B does archive through its CCC or mini chromosomal transcriptional template. And so we've learned from the HIV group that compensatory mutations do fix it in the genetic archive. So we are very concerned about these mutations because of our ability to rescue subsequently. What's the story with adefovir? We have a lot of patients who under expanded access programs started with adefovir. Typically, we have the major pathway of resistance is the 236T pathway, typically lamivudine sensitive, but does actually, over time, become multi-drug resistant and does actually have a blunted response, in our experience, to tenofovir. We're now starting to see other mutations with more widespread use of adefovir that affect the N236 region, the A, V, and the S. We're still characterising those in the laboratory at the moment. We see lots of A181T and V, with and without the 204I, depending on their previous exposure to lamivudine, which is broadly cross-resistant to tenofovir and broadly multi-drug resistant. So we're sort of seeing lots of these as well. Now, as I said, with entecavir, our major experience in Melbourne with entecavir has been in the setting of lamivudine failure and therefore a rescue with entecavir. And typically we're starting out with a 180204 lamivudine-resistant genotype, And then we just all needed one more mutation, at least a 169 plus a 250, but already that sort of compromises entecavir, but does actually also compromise your ability to rescue with lamivudine and dolutegravir. Now, there's been a lot of interest in entecavir in naive patients and a lot of discussion, and we're going to sort of see as entecavir is approved and hopefully prescribed more frequently in the naive situation, that what happens to patients that receive entecavir in this particular scenario. And what I've shown is a patient that was published, it's a Japanese patient that was published in Journal of Clinical Virology earlier this year. it's in the public domain, kindly given to me by Professor Hans Tillman. And I sort of missed that paper, but you can see here that the viral loads shown on the side here, they're going down, and they respond very well to entecavir. I will point out that this patient, for whatever reason, didn't use the recommended original dose of 0.5 milligrams. This was a naive patient, so the therapeutic dose is 0.5, but started with 0.1 for about 2 to 3 months, and then was switched across to 0.5. And you can see it's still got a good response with 0.1, which is the less than optimized dose. Very, very good suppression, but you can see here that here's your baseline, and then you can see here that in terms of at this point here, just double-check the slide, you're doing two, yes, that we're starting to sort of see not one, not two, but three mutations appear, and then, interestingly, the virus takes off. But you need three mutations to occur at once, it appears, to break through on entecavir in the naive situation. So I think it's going to be important because we know that single and double mutations pre-exist. Triple mutations do require a lot more in terms of the genetic barrier to actually become resistant to. But I'm starting to be convinced by patients such as these, as case records appear in the literature, that we need three mutations in order to engender entecavir resistance. But so for tolbivudine, we have few patients in Melbourne, but this is from the FDA website for the package insert for tolbivudine. Again, the major mutational pathway is the 204I pathway, which is obviously cross-resistant with lamivudine. But really, I was surprised to read in the FDA submission was the 181T is important. This is broadly cross-resistant with adefovir and tenofovir. And also, I think the 229 pathway, which we're also characterising at the moment, will have important implications in further rescue options. So where are we going now? Because our patients in Melbourne are a little bit longer out in terms of therapy. We have a number of patients, as I said, who are now multi-drug resistant, starting whether you start with adefovir or lamivudine, it doesn't matter. This particular patient group cluster started with adefovir, 236T, rescue with lamivudine failed, selected out to 181. The combination, these were alternating monotherapies, and then went back onto a combination at this stage of their treatment. That's a typical scenario in the way hepatitis B has been managed over the last decade. You end up typically now with a 180, 181 and a 204, and then one compensatory mutation away, 233 with a 250. And as I said, we have no drug that I am aware of that is able to treat this particular HBV isolate. Those four mutations are on the one genome. Being a reference laboratory, it is our job to actually make some of these mutants and then actually test it in vitro phenotypes. It's a very slow, labour-intensive process, and try and get some sort of IC50 values. And this is, I'm showing, fold increases. The L-nucleosides, easy to become resistant to, big shifts in IC50, between 100 and 1,000-fold shifts with a classic L204I pathway. You can see what is interesting, though, is you don't need a lot with a 181TV pathway, very low IC50 fold increases, but unfortunately they do compromise your ability to rescue with the acyclic phosphonates, with adefovir and tenofovir. You know, 3 to 5-fold increase with an A181TV renders these drugs ineffective clinically. And with entecavir, you've got a partial blunting with the 204 pathway. With entecavir, a 30-fold increase. But then when you put on one or two of the extra mutations of the 250 or the 169 or the 202 or a 184, there's a very, very, very accelerated increase in IC50. So obviously we need to be doing more of the phenotypic analyses to be able to provide the physician with some degree of comfort in terms of their ability to rescue. So in my last 3 minutes, I'll just finish up with some more of the recent activities that we're doing, and just to remind you some of the interesting anatomical considerations of hepatitis B virus. Hepatitis B is a circular genome with four open reading frames that are frame-shifted. You wouldn't believe your bad luck, but drug resistance in terms of the viral polymerase directly overlaps, but in a frame-shifted way, the neutralization domain of the envelope. This is an extremely important consideration and one that I wish we had more resources to characterize, but 80% of the drug-resistant viral changes that we see do result in a significant change in the viral envelope. And I've listed all four drugs that are approved here in Australia. They all cause changes. Here they are. They're mapped on the catalytic domain of the enzyme, and they all affect the neutralization domain of the envelope. The neutralization domain of the envelope is also a little bit like HIV in that it's a conformational epitope. And I've shown for you here the A determinant, the major neutralization loop. You can see here it's a group of cysteine rafts. And you can see here is the major classic G145R classic vaccine or D144E vaccine escape mutant or HBIG escape. The lamivudine resistant mutations that I'll show you, or the drug resistant mutations, 161, 164, 173, these are all down what we call the C terminal end, but they do actually, and you might think, oh, that's a long way away from the neutralization domain up here, but I can reassure you, being a conformational epitope, in a study that Joe Teresi did in my lab some years ago, these lamivudine resistant mutants were compared to the classic vaccine escape mutants in their ability to bind anti-HBS. And you can see here that the vaccine escape mutants typically have a binding capability over 55 grams per mil, and that, that there is certainly increasing or a increased binding compromise activity with the lamivudine-resistant mutants, but this 173, 182, 04, but had the same binding capacity as the vaccine escape mutants shown for you here. And that, to show you where that is, it's just there. So, and since then we've had lots more. Now, why is this important? Certainly it's important in co-infection. In a collaborative study with Chloe Theo in the Johns Hopkins and Greg Dorr and Gail Matthews' group at the National Centre and Sharon Lewin's group in Melbourne and with Jay Sassajuice, we looked at our HIV-HBV co-infected cohort that were actually had lamivudine experience, and we're looking for the selection of this particular mutant that I described in the previous paper, the 173, the 182.04, and with the duration of lamivudine therapy, you can see it's a 173, which is what driving the vaccine escape or the reduced binding. It's a compensatory mutation. You can see that the longer you leave them on lamivudine, the more frequently you see increase in this particular pattern of selection of that virus. And in a collaboration with Professor Soriano's group, we've looked at a cohort in Europe, and Dr. Soriano has been able to sort of describe the classic sort of spontaneous mutants that we see with associated with vaccine escape or selective pressure of vaccine and HBIG, but also he's characterized a very large number of drug-selected mutants at the C-terminal end of the HBSAG that that are very important in terms of their ability to act as vaccine escape. So why are these important? Well, I think to an audience as sophisticated as this group here, these resistant changes in HBV selected by nucleoside nucleotide analogues obviously affect HBsAg antigenicity, especially in genotype A patients as well as genotype D patients from Professor Soriano's group. And really, I think that does actually pose the question there that we should be doing more genotyping, more HBV genotyping and polymerase sequencing in our patients as they go on to nucleoside nucleotide analogue therapy. Now, why this is important is that Vincent Thibault in Paris, as well as our group at Melbourne, have now got several cases of transmission of lamivudine-resistant HBV in the setting of men having sex with men. And so far, the cases have only been resolved in typical acute hepatitis B, but I suspect that what's really happening in higher prevalence parts of the world, such as Asia and in Africa, where lamivudine or drug resistance is much more of an issue, it's in terms of its practical issue, but it's not being properly proper surveillance, I think that we will be seeing lots of the examples of transmission of drug-resistant and multi-drug-resistant hepatitis B. And in my last couple of seconds, we've been some new data that I think is important to present here today. We've been looking a lot in the last 1 year at the A181T mutant, especially with the reasons you'll see in a minute. And the reason why that's important is that, as well as causing doesn't cause a change, it causes a premature truncation of the C-terminal end. There's a stop codon where the tryptophan at 172 is. And that shows you where that is, maps on the hepatitis B surface antigen just there. This was done by Nania Warner, a graduate student in my laboratory. So the HBV encoding the RTA181T, it's defective in virion secretion because it's got a truncated envelope. But what we've found, which is quite important, is that it acts as a dominant negative mutant for wild-type HBV secretion. And as you've shown in this slide very nicely, it's actually retained inside the cell. And when we looked at our database, we found that even though it accounts for only 2% of the lamivudine-resistant cases, you say, oh, that's not important, but it accounts for over 20% of the adetavir-resistant cases. And so what we're seeing is that in the presence of the A181T, the kinetics of relapse or kinetics of virological rebound are compromised. And I've just shown for you here three typical patients. Typically what we see with lamivudine or adetavir resistance is that we get 2 to 4 log breakthrough over 3 to 6 months. And what we're now starting to see is either no change in viral load or 1 log increase over 12 months or barely just on 1 log at 12 months or 1 to 2 logs at 12 months. So I think that the presence of the A181T does now start to challenge, and we're seeing more of it, that the classic case definition of greater than 1 log increase from NADA over 3 to 6 months. So, Gail, thank you very much for the opportunity to come here today and highlight to you the current emerging patterns of antiviral drug resistance and hepatitis B. They're getting more and more complicated, I'm sorry to say. We're seeing primary resistance mutations across groups now. The A181TV pathway, the third pathway that I described today, we're seeing that more and more frequently now, as well as the 204 and the 236T pathways. But more importantly, in terms of practical patient or physician management, in terms of your ability to rescue your patients, we're seeing these broad clusters of compensatory mutations during lamivudine and adefovir therapy, that such as 214, 215, 169, 173, 184, and 202, that do really compromise your ability to actually future rescue patients. So obviously pulse sequencing is important. There's obviously a need for interactive database programs on a global level, and I really do highlight the concern that the virologist has of the polymerase envelope link and the public health risk associated with that. Thank you very much.
Stephen, thank you, as usual, for an illuminating talk on hepatitis B resistance, which is only going to become more complex, I think, as time goes on. Question from the microphone there.
Richmond, San Diego. So, Stephen, that was terrific, as usual. But you've been telling us this story for many years, and nobody seems to be doing anything about it. So sort of analogous to global warming, do you think the problem is practitioners and drug companies don't believe it, or they don't want to do anything about it?
Well, I think that in Asia it's a huge issue, and I believe there's just not enough commitment to really defining the problem. If you don't take a temperature, you can't diagnose a fever. So the extent of resistance is really, it's epidemic in Asia. Because of inappropriate use of lamivudine. Lamivudine is widely available in Asia, and the way it's treated, the way it's used and prescribed is completely inappropriate, and it's a mess. But no one seems to care. It's only hepatitis B, so why should you worry? It's only the 10th leading cause of death worldwide, liver disease. But we can't seem to get anyone really interested anymore. I guess we've got HIV and hep C, so hep B can fall off the radar screen.
I think Marion's got a question.
So, just a comment. The DHHS guidelines in the US for co-infection recommend dual therapy. The ASLD guidelines recommend dual therapy for transplant and cirrhosis. So we're slowly getting there. And I think that's an important point because it's a change over the last 6 months.
Well, if I might respond to that, Marion, my reading of the guidelines was that combination can be considered in cirrhosis. Even the American gastroenterology guidelines can be considered. It was not a straight out use combinations. It was can be
That's
considered.
That's correct.
Which is not enough. I don't think it's enough. Not in 2007. I was really disappointed when I read those guidelines last month.
There's another question just on the left there.
Hi, Steve O'Brien, Oakland. For those of us who treat co-infected patients and have access to the tenofovir FTC fixed-dose combination, our strategy in naive patients is often just to empirically start that fixed-dose combination. Can you comment on that?
Look, I think that's a great combination, and I think that the golden rule in infectious disease is your first chance is your best chance. I presented you a scenario that was basically become because of the way drugs were approved in hepatitis B, and the way that, so, you know, the practitioners, to be fair, only had lamivudine for a very long period of time, so they tended to sort of just keep patients on lamivudine. But, if we could go wind the clock back and say we had Truvada straight up, or lamivudine plus adefovir straight up, then, entecovir, if entecovir is, with a three mutation profile, is equivalent to a combination. You'd have to argue that from a mutational virological standpoint. So if you wind the clock back and use those sorts of drugs with a high genetic barrier, either a combination of Truvada, a combination of FTC plus tenofovir or lamivudine plus adefovir or entecovir monotherapy with our current understanding, and I am a committed combination therapy person, but I have to concede that, yes, with entecovir in naive patients, you need three mutations to generate resistance, then, yeah, that's actually a good way to go. But, and that has to be the way to go. And I think the responses that we see when we do treat naive patients are great. And you get very good suppression with hepatitis B virus DNA with those sorts of approaches if you start out in the initial naive patients with those three various approaches.
Thanks, Stephen, once again.
Okay, we're going to move on to our last presentation, which will be given by Professor Vincent Soriano. Vincent works in Madrid, Spain, at the Hospital Carlos de Fierro, and he's going to give a talk on HPV evolving treatment paradigms in HIV-HPV co-infected patients.
Good evening. I realize to say tercero may be a little difficult for German. So I will focus on something more more clinical regarding the co-infection of hepatitis B and HIV. And I will not try to cover everything. And in fact, I just decided to move and focus on the use of new diagnostic and monitoring methods to make the appropriate management of these patients, when to treat and which anti-hepatitis drugs to use. I will comment just at the end about delta hepatitis because sometimes it's forgotten by everyone, and also about the co-infection of hepatitis B and C in this population. So, and the first message is that in the old times we just make the attention in the liver in people with chronic hepatitis B, the finite MAP, people with surface antigen for longer than 6 months, this is the definition of the chronic hepatitis B, just looking at the liver with palpation and demonstrating that was a liver enlargement, looking at the aminotransferases and looking at the serology, whether the patient was or not with the old replicative pathway, antigen E, or doing a liver biopsy. The treatment until just a few years was limited to a very few options. And in fact, in the past, we recommended to stop drinking, avoid spicy meals and relaxing lifestyles. But now, in 2007, really, we have learned many things from the HIV field. And with the respects to my colleagues hepatologists, we think that probably all the advances that the research in HIV has put on the room has helped a lot to change the mentality to approach hepatitis B and hepatitis C. And in fact, looking at the new methods to monitoring this disease, we look at the viral load, we look at the genotypes. We have learned in the previous presentation about the use and the importance of monitoring resistance. And for liver biopsy, we have now new non-invasive tools like the FibroScan. We have plenty of new drugs. This just arrived to the market. But now, in addition to the old interferon, we have lamivudine, entricitabine, adefovir, entecavir, telvivudine, and probably within a few years or month, we will have also tenofovir, as you know very well. All these drugs, the potent new drugs, tenofovir and FTC, already are used by many HIV clinicians because they are approved for HIV, but not yet for hepatitis B. The importance of the viral load for the prognosis of hepatitis B has been clearly demonstrated in two papers last year, but the message here is that besides the old transaminases, right now we rely on viral load for hepatitis B to predict what will happen in the near future. And in fact, if using something, some drug, we put these patients below 100,000 copies per ml, which means dividing by 5, 20,000 international units per ml, these patients will show less liver inflammation and less fibrosis. If we put these patients below 10 to the 4, there will be more durable response of antigen E loss. If we put these patients below 1,000, in fact, the emergence of resistance could become very difficult to these two patients. Like in HIV, if there is no ongoing replication, the selection of resistance mutations becomes very, very difficult for the virus. And as long as you have complete viral suppression, it's just a matter of time. You will lose the surface antigen. The two papers I mentioned before that are crucial, and for those interested to learn more about the impact and the crucial role of hepatitis B viremia in prognosis in hepatitis B, well, here are the reference. In the first, viral load is directly correlated positively with the risk of developing cirrhosis. And in the second, the titer of viremia is also correlated with the risk of developing hepatocellular carcinoma. The genotypes. Like in HIV, we have several subtypes in HIV, and some of them have clinical implications. HIV2, for example, is not sensitive to non-nucleosides. Well, in hepatitis B, we don't have a lot of information, but we have starting to learn that some of the genotypes, for example, genotype A, is more sensitive to interferon, and at the same time is usually associated with higher titers of viremia and may develop faster resistance to 3TC. Hepatitis, the genotypes B and C are more common in Asia, and B looks like a little, let's say, better in the sense that it's more benign and more sensitive to interferon. Genotype D is the other prevalent genotype in Europe, especially with genotype A, and really this genotype provides a lot of trouble to our patients. Usually they are antigen E negative, and the prognosis tends to be worse. For the assessment of liver fibrosis, as I mentioned before, now we are starting to collect more and more data replacing liver biopsy. What we need to justify the treatment for hepatitis B is to demonstrate some damage in the liver, some fibrosis that may just predicts the risk of developing cirrhosis, the end stage of the liver disease. And now, with some serum fibrosis markers and the FibroScan, a new imaging technique, we can clearly split those patients with very advanced fibrosis, significant fibrosis to justify therapy, and those with no evidence of lesions in the liver, those patients are those that we can wait to start therapy. We can repeat the FibroScan every 6 months for these patients and collect information longitudinally and in one moment decide that this is the moment to start therapy. In HIV, hepatitis B is a priority, and there is a lot of information collected over the last years to justify that. The co-infection is common, as we will see later on. There is a deleterious influence of HIV on chronic hepatitis B in terms of more rapid progression to end-stage liver disease, increased risk of liver-related mortality, and a poor tolerance of the antiretroviral drugs when you have underlying chronic hepatitis B. There are several guidelines to treat co-infected patients, and we will discuss a little bit on that. And the advantage here, and this is something new, some of the agents we are using for treating HIV are at the same time useful to treat hepatitis B. So we can just we can fight two different agents with the same compound. And this is the case, as you know very well, for tenofovir. Well, the numbers of patients in the world co-infected, well, we estimated that there are around 40 million people living with HIV. It's 400 million, one log more, for hepatitis B, chronic hepatitis B. And the intersection, those with HIV having chronic hepatitis B, is around, let's say, 10% overall. So that means 4 million people, in fact, in the world, is having both HIV and hepatitis B. Everything that happens in the natural history of hepatitis B, clearing naturally the infection, this is 95% in adults exposed to hepatitis B, or developing the higher replicative state, and for those with high viremia developing end-stage liver disease, everything, as I say, is worse in the HIV setting. So the rate of chronicity is higher when you are infected by HIV. The proportion of people with the antigen E, the replicative form, is higher. The titer of viremia tends to be also higher, and the risk to develop end-stage liver complications occurs faster. And in fact, the data, for example, from EuroSIDA, and this has also been reproduced by the John Hopkins, by Chloe Thio, is that looking at the new age events, there is not much different compared people with antigen, with a chronic hepatitis B and not, but looking at the global mortality, and especially the liver-related mortality, in the multivariate analysis, these patients died more. So when to treat hepatitis E? We need to treat everyone with the surface antigen? No. Some of these patients may have a containing the disease. They may start with no liver inflammation at the moment, but later on maybe that situation may change. And in fact, the old European guidelines published in 2003 recommended that treatment probably was justified in the presence of elevated ALT levels, antigen E, or high levels of viremia. And why? Because doing a liver biopsy in these patients, almost all of them have significant fibrosis to justify therapy because these patients progress faster. So in this situation was a justification to initiate therapy. The new guidelines from the American Association for the Study of the Liver, in summary, just focus on the same message, more or less. So when you have elevated ALT levels, despite you were or not with antigen E, there is the justification for therapy. In the specific situation that the ALT are normal and you have antigen E negative, but you have high viremia, also in that specific situation, these are probably the patients who has the mutant that precludes the production of the antigen E. These patients progress faster to end-stage liver disease and also is a justification for therapy. What drugs to use? I mentioned before, and we heard before from Professor Locarnini, we have plenty of new drugs and with the concerns of resistance and cross-resistance. But right now, register, we have interferon alpha, PEG interferon, who has replaced the classical interferon alpha. The treatment is for 1 year. But for all the others, we need to provide probably the therapy forever. Let's say until the moment we will reach the zero conversion for the surface antigen, or sometimes being more conservative, the antigen E zero conversion. And we have lamivudine, adefovir, and entecavir, telvivudine just approved a few months ago. And just because we are treating co-infected patients, we have the chance to use FTC and tenofovir. The new molecule that probably will be approved soon will be clavulin, which is very potent. 2 years ago, in fact, the manage and the drugs to use in co-infected patients was very dependent, and this is still true right now, of the need to treat HIV. If we don't need to treat HIV with antiretroviral drugs, we have two different positions. One is when the patient has antigen E. In that situation, the use of pegylated interferon for 1 year may provide sustained reduction in hepatitis B viremia in around 20% of the patients. In co-infected patients, probably this rate may be lower, but the chance is so high that probably with very high CD4 counts, the chance to use pegylated interferon can be defended for some patients. When you don't have antigen E, the response to interferon is quite poor, let's say very poor. And this is why nucleoside analogs, which are very well tolerated, they are oral drugs once a day. Well, we can discuss to use entecavir or adefovir or telvivudine. As you are very much aware, just in Denver a few months ago, was a claim that entecavir may select some resistance in HIV. The same has been a matter of concern also for adefovir, even using the 10 milligrams approved for hepatitis B. And with telvivudine, we have learned that has no activity against HIV, but the selection of resistance is between adefovir and lamivudine. So really, using monotherapy with telvivudine in this situation, probably no one will put the signature there. Everything becomes much easier when you need to treat HIV, because we have Truvada. We just have a question a few minutes ago. So with Truvada, this is something magic. I can tell you that. So, and you have experienced a lot about that. So in co-infected patients, if there is a justification to initiate HIV therapy, always use Truvada. This is the way to reach undetectable viremia in hepatitis B. But what will happen if the patient has some kidney troubles or kidney disturbances? What would to do? Well, the data using combination therapy in hepatitis B are scarce, has not demonstrated a more pronounced reduction in viremia, and so far the benefit is just limited to the minimization, to the reduction of the selection of resistance for the compounds in use. Well, these data are already being discussed by Professor Locarnini, but this is the rate of selection of resistance mutations using lamivudine or adefovir. With the new drug, with telbidudin, we are using the middle. But really the message here is that I think no one will put the fingers and say that probably telbidudin will be a monotherapy, a good drug to be used in people who don't need antiretroviral therapy. Because selecting in hepatitis B, despite there is no evidence of activity against HIV, in telbidudin, you will lose, by cross-resistance, many other options in the future, including entecavir. Already has been mentioned by Professor Locarnini, and what about the risk of transmission of these resistance variants? There is not much information on that, but I'm sure that as all these drugs, especially in the HIV co-infected field, are widely used by our patients, and infection is not clear, and these patients continue to be in risky behavior, we will assist more and more patients with resistance to lamivudine in hepatitis B. Arefovir is effective in the long term with substantial seroconversions in antigen E and S. There is selection of resistance, but this is low and at low rate, less than for lamivudine. They are specific mutations that don't cross in general, cross resistance to lamivudine, except some positions like the 181 that was mentioned before. But for some reason, it's still unclear. And let's say that 5% to 10% of our patients taking well the medication, being compliant, don't respond. And this is, has been a matter of debate and controversy. And the other critical question is, if we use arefovir, 10 milligrams, in people who don't need antiretroviral therapy, we will select in HIV the K65R mutation that may confer cross-resistance to tenofovir. Well, very few studies have looked at that. And just Julie Sheldon and our lab just reported that in a small, relatively small group of patients from Europe, in collaboration with Jürgen and Stefan Maus in Germany, there was no evidence of selection of the K65R in HIV in people exposed to arefovir monotherapy for a while. And the analysis extended to endpoint dilution to look for minor quasi-species present in these patients. So at the moment, it looks like maybe relatively safe to use arefovir when you need the treatment of hepatitis B without needing the antiretroviral therapy. The reasons to fail arefovir, as I mentioned before, one of the reasons is that we are using 10 milligrams, which is a low dose, and because higher doses, as you know very well, may produce nephrotoxicity. Well, low antiviral activity intrinsic by the drug, poor drug exposure in some compartments in the liver, some polymorphies causing natural resistance, one of them already has been mentioned before, cross resistance to lamivudine, especially when the mutations appear at this position, and in genotype A2, which is the predominant in Europe and the US, not in Asia, which is the predominant is A1, these polymorphies is in the pathway with another ones to produce natural resistance to arefovir, like we see, for example, in HIV-2, with there is natural resistance to non-nucleoside analogs. Entecavir, the data in co-infected patients previously exposed to lamivudine showed that the drug was potent and produced a reduction of at least 4 logs at 1 year. But as time passes by and these patients continue to be on entecavir, it's just a matter of time. Those who are still with detectable viremia will accumulate mutations and they will fail because the mutations that produce resistance to lamivudine are in the pathway for the resistance to entecavir. Just 1 month ago, there was more intriguing information that was already reported preliminarily at the CROI that entecavir, when it's used in patients, co-infected patients without antiretroviral therapy, may select for resistance mutations in HIV and produce antiviral activity against HIV in vivo. The data came from 3 patients on follow-up at the Johns Hopkins, and on average, the reduction in HIV was of 1 log. One of the patients doing clonal analysis over 6 months was an accumulation, a slowly accumulation of the 184B in HIV. But there was another patient, number 3, that despite being exposed to entecavir monotherapy for 7 months, there was no evidence of selection of the 184 mutation. Just in a clonal analysis, one in around out of, I think, was more than 50 clones, had this 184 mutation after 7 months of exposure to entecavir. So this is something a little strange. In the in vitro analysis done in by a very expert group, they were able to demonstrate some activity in vitro in viral culture of entecavir against HIV. And in fact, the FDA make a warning and recommended to avoid the use of entecavir monotherapy when there is no concomitant antiretroviral therapy use. However, I don't know the experience of some in the audience maybe using entecavir as monotherapy in co-infected patients, but we have the opportunity to study one of our patients that was a patient with Delta. Delta, as you know very well, may superinfect hepatitis B patients, and because there is viral interference when you have Delta, many of the patients have undetectable viremia for hepatitis B. We treated this patient with Delta, with entecavir, with more than 500 CD4 cell because he was acirrhotic and he was progressing very fast. And we provided something that we thought was the only opportunity to ameliorate their disease. And these are the data. So at the beginning, there was undetectable viremia for hepatitis B, was high levels of viremia for Delta, and putting this patient on entecavir, there was no significant change in viremia in HIV using 1 milligram of entecavir. But there was more. On the follow-up, and this is 6-month follow-up at the moment, there was no selection of the 184B. So for some reason, still my view is that this topic is still open. And for some reason, still unclear, this potential activity of entecavir against HIV merits further investigation. There is more than that. If we recommend to use entecavir in people who need antiretroviral therapy, we will need to have more information about interactions. And we have learned about that, for example, the story of ribavirin and abacavir treating hepatitis C with antiretroviral therapy. Both are guanosine analogs, and they may compete. And in fact, there is data from the Ribavit trial and from our group that show that people treated for hepatitis C taking abacavir may respond less, because the competition between abacavir and ribavirin. And entecavir is also a guanosine analog. So if we decide to treat co-infection between HIV and hepatitis B in people who is receiving abacavir, what will be the effect of using entecavir? There will be some interference and inhibitory competition. We don't use ACT and D4T because they inhibit each other. Well, we need this information before recommending to use entecavir in people with antiretroviral therapy, especially taking abacavir. Tenofovir. Well, tenofovir, not yet approved for hepatitis B, but really, the data from the clinical practice from all of you probably is that there is a significant reduction in people with already resistance to lamivudine. And the interesting thing here is that sometimes the response tend to be slow to tenofovir. Very potent drug, but sometimes it takes long periods to reach undetectable viremia, sometimes more than 1 year. Marion Peters, one of the speakers, the first speakers, she was the leader of one of the ACTGs comparing in a non-inferiority trial the activity of tenofovir versus adefovir. And really, the message here, the study was discontinued prematurely because the endpoint was reached, was the non-inferiority of tenofovir versus adefovir. But the message here is that we extended the study. Probably we will conclude that there was more activity of tenofovir versus adefovir. So really, tenofovir is very potent against hepatitis B. As many drugs, as many will say, if something is active, we'll select for resistance. There is not something magical in all these antiviral drugs. That's true. And in fact, with the collaboration with Professor Locarnini, Julie Sheldon, studying patients from Europe, check at people with detectable viremia under tenofovir for longer than 6 months. And she was able to recognize a mutation that in combination with the mutations for lamivudine produce in vitro more than tenfold IC50 for the drug. The intriguing thing here, and we have now 3 of these patients, is that these patients reach undetectable viremia after 1 year, even or despite the presence of this mutation. So really, the exact role and the relevance, the clinical relevance of the mutation is still merits further research. Just to make things simple, probably they are more complex, but at the moment, we can just put in an axis the potency and the genetic barrier. We are familiar using this graph for HIV, but for hepatitis B, we may say that the drugs with low genetic barrier are mainly lamivudine and FTC. With more potency are tenofovir, entecavir, and telvivudine, and with less potency are efovir. For interferon, there is no evidence of resistance in the virus. It's something different, a different mechanism. So let's say put him totally separated. The message here also is that when we will think about combination therapy, all the pathways Dr. Locarnini has mentioned before need to be restricted because there is only one target, the polymerase of hepatitis B, to the potential combination of the drugs in red with the drugs in green, the nucleosides with the nucleotides. It's not a good idea to try to combine lamivudine with LDT or entecavir with LDT because all of them are in the same pathway of resistance. Farianzulen, in a more conservative approach that combination therapy, that, as I mentioned before, the data supporting more antiviral potency are still lacking, no evidence for that, just protection of selecting resistance, has made this point, and I think it's attractive in the sense that he defends that probably using very potent drugs, not lamivudine, because it's too fragile, but like entecavir or adefovir or tenofovir, we can start with monotherapy. And in 6 months, we don't reach undetectable viremia. This is the threshold for starting to put these drugs at risk for resistance. We need to add something more and start the combination therapy, not from the beginning, but at 6 months. But if you reach undetectable viremia with only one compound, you can spare the cost and the tolerance of new combination, new drugs added from the beginning to this approach. Well, the benefit of putting these patients with undetectable viremia for a while, just 2 points, and this has been reproduced also by the French group of investigators. As long as you stay with undetectable viremia, it's just a matter of time. The rate of seroconversion of the antigen E, the rate of seroconversion of the surface antigen is increasing. So as long as you have undetectable viremia, and this is the goal, to put these patients with undetectable viremia for a while. And in this study, for example, this is 5 years with drugs active against hepatitis B in HIV co-infected patients. The proportion reaching clearance of the surface antigen is growing and growing up. And this is translated also in a benefit in the liver. And using, for example, the FibroScan, you can see that the proportion of patients, co-infected patients, with 6 years on average of undetectable viremia for hepatitis B is really low. And this explains that in a country like my country, that we have transplanted more than 100 patients right now, the proportion with chronic hepatitis B is very low. Almost all the liver transplants in co-infected patients are due to hepatitis C and a few delta. But for B, using lamivudine and for the last 5 years, tenofovir, all these patients are going off the list of transplants because liver fibrosis is stopped and sometimes there is evidence of regression. Just one slide on Delta and the other on dual infections. Delta. This is a strange, very small virus. It's a subviral satellite of hepatitis B virion that uses the surface antigens for genotype encapsulation. It's a circular RNA molecule, very small, a half hepatitis B. 5% overall in the world of hepatitis B carriers are infected with Delta, but that represents 50 million people. Half of patients progress to liver cirrhosis within 20 years. This is the more aggressive hepatitis virus. Delta replication use not polymerases from the virus, only host polymerases, and that is critical because we will not develop specific drugs against Delta. And intensive interferon therapy is the only available treatment option, and the response is quite poor in any case. Well, we have the opportunity to study 15 Delta patients co-infected with HIV. So this is HIV, hepatitis B, and Delta. And we provide them 3TC, FTC, plus, minus, tenofovir. And we selected these patients because they have undetectable viremia for hepatitis B, because most of them, because the interference, they have undetectable viremia for hepatitis B from the beginning. But Delta viremia was very high. And what we saw, extending the duration of follow-up for 6 years, was a significant reduction in Delta viremia. And in our knowledge, this is one of the first evidence that nucleosides for extended period of therapy and being successful at making complete suppression of hepatitis B replication may be somewhat active against Delta. And in fact, in this series, this was presented in Paris a few months ago, oral by Julie Sheldon, there was a normalization of LT levels in a significant proportion of these patients, and in two of them that discontinued therapy for some reason, there was a flare-up in Delta viremia and in transaminases. So looks like prolonged successful therapy for hepatitis B may benefit also Delta virus. And for those co-infected with hepatitis C and surface and chronic hepatitis B, what to do? These patients, and there are several papers that have shown that, they progress faster to liver disease, so the prognosis is much poorer. Well, in this study, treating patients which who have the hepatitis C replicating virus or the hepatitis B, the message was that treating hepatitis B was no evidence of any single rebound in hepatitis B viremia. And just the contrary also was true in the majority of patients. Treating hepatitis C was no evidence of significant relapse in B viremia when the treatment was provided and stopped later on, interferon plus ribavirin. So that means that treating these patients, treating with the replicating virus in these patients, there is not much risk, at least in a significant proportion of these patients, to a rebound, a escape of the other virus, because was presumed viral interference at the beginning. So in summary, chronic hepatitis B progressed faster in HIV. It increased the risk of hepatotoxicity using antiretroviral agents. The treatment of hepatitis B should be considered as a priority for these reasons. All co-infected patients should be tested for viral load, the genotype, and liver fibrosis assessed by either non-invasive tools or biopsy. Don't use TTC or FTC as only anti-hepatitis B agent at front in 2007. This is very clear. And only economic restrictions may justify to do the contrary. Hepatitis B therapy plan should be individualized based on the need for HIV treatment. This is the first condition, and prior TTC therapy. A stop and regression of advanced liver fibrosis can be seen with prolonged and sustained suppression of viremia. Exclude always Delta hepatitis in all hepatitis B surface antigen positive patients and treat the active replicating virus in dual infected patients. And just to finish, this was presented nearly 1 year and a half ago at the Denver conference, and I think this is the message probably will be the best thing to take home from this lecture, is that this happens in the U.S. This is not Tanzania or a very poor country. No, it's the U.S. So they presented this place. So this is a group of 362 co-infected patients. This is a large number of co-infected patients. Only 18% of them have been tested for the E antigen or have made the viral load test for hepatitis B. And only one-third had these measurements before starting HARP. Among 162 patients who began HARP, the median number of tests for HIV viremia at 1 year was 3. In contrast, for hepatitis B viremia was 0. The frequency of hepatic ultrasounds was only one-third of the patients. Only 43% of cirrhotic had alpha-fetoprotein measurements, the risk for hepatocellular carcinoma, and the conclusion of the authors of the abstract was that the providers did much better in HIV than in hepatitis B care, at least in this co-infected population. And just for those more interested in co-infection, just announced that next year, in June, there is will be the fourth co-infection meeting and will be held in Madrid in 1921 of the next year. And thanks for your attention.
All right. Thank you very much for this very nice and comprehensive overview. I think Gail has a question.
Yeah, Vincent, I was just going to ask about hepatic flare after initiation of hepatitis B active heart and whether you see this often in your population and whether you have a specific strategy for those patients that you can't treat through, so people with cirrhosis maybe at baseline.
I think this is a good question. Sometimes you start with Truvada in a patient with hepatitis B and another compound, a protease inhibitor or a non-nucleoside, and after a few weeks you see an elevation in transaminases, and always the doubt is whether there is hepatotoxicity of the antiretroviral drugs you are using, or there is a seroconversion of the hepatitis B, a clearance, that is associated with an elevation in transaminases. You need to check that repeating the serologies. This is a good way to do that. And in some cases, if the transaminases are not going very, very high, let's say more than threefold, I will recommend to stay on therapy and not putting the patient at risk. But if the transaminases are going very, very high, I will stop the therapy at the moment. Yeah.
Do you ever use an induction strategy to bring down the hepatitis B DNA first before you start?
That's also a good question, but becomes very difficult because you will need to use some drugs that are active against HIV, putting the risk for selecting HIV resistance. So you will need to do something like with arefovir at the beginning and later on switch to tenofovir and FTC. And I feel that many of the practitioners will not do that.
Okay, well, there are no further questions and we're a bit over time, so I'd like to bring this session to a close and thank once again all the presenters for really very excellent talks today and a really nice summary of the data.